Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. Today, May 28, 2006. I'm Bob McChesney, coming to you from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign from beautiful Urbana, Illinois, on this scorching and lovely Sunday summer afternoon. In addition to media, probably the core institutions that are instrumental in forming the quality of a political democracy are the electoral institutions, laws, parties, rules governing elections, how they're done. Today we're going to be talking to one of the great experts on that subject, Stephen Hill, author of a brand new book, 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy. And we'll be talking about what can be done today to make our democracy more effective and the role media has to play in that process. So join me today, but first let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson. In New York,
our internet, our public access television, it's under attack.
In Boston,
the Koch bill is no less than a challenge to our First Amendment rights to be heard in an open society. This bill does not promote free speech and expression, but instead seeks ways to limit it.
In Chicago,
we have to now become constantly vigilant.
And in San Francisco, concerned citizens mobilized on May 24th in a national day of outrage against the telecom industry's drive to pass the COPE Act. This bill, pending in the House along with similar legislation in the Senate, would essentially allow phone and cable companies to turn the internet into a pay-to-speak system similar to cable TV networks, and would also severely curtail local government authority to negotiate franchise deals with cable TV providers that fund public, educational, and government access channels. In New York, people gathered outside Verizon World headquarters. Betty Yu with SaveAccess.org was especially incensed about the current disinformation campaign going on in Washington, D.C. and online, funded by phone and cable companies who oppose network neutrality and community television.
These phone companies have created fake AstroTurf nonprofit organizations pretending to speak for the public. But we know this is corporate propaganda. So we want to tell Verizon, do you hear us now? We're out here. We're outraged. And we're not going to stop.
A rally at the Massachusetts State House heard David Eisenberg, a fellow at Harvard Law School's Berkman Center for Internet and Society and member of the Save the Internet Coalition, debunk phone company objections to preserving an open internet through the principle of network neutrality.
The telephone companies say, you can trust us. Well, $200 billion worth of tax breaks and rate relief later, we are number 16 in nations in broadband service penetration and falling. The telephone companies have stolen our broadband future. We should not trust them.
Protesters in Chicago gathered in front of the AT&T building downtown and expressed concern about how the company's reassembling the old Ma Bell. This unnamed rally participant explained why it was important for him to take time out midweek to let the company know he was one angry customer.
There's a principle of freedom that's sort of gone along with the development of the internet and moves by SBC, now AT&T, and other telecom companies jeopardize that equality of access and that freedom, which makes these technologies so democratically empowering.
Back in Boston, Steve Early with the Communications Workers of America District 1 says those who work inside the telecom giants see the writing on the wall.
This is their vision of the future. It is two-tier, and it will leave us, both as workers and consumers, on the wrong side of the digital divide.
He was echoed in New York by Daniel Johnson with CWA Local 11, which represents many Verizon employees.
Management, if you're hearing this, be prepared. This war is not going to be an easy one. We've got folks on the inside and the outside.
Those who gathered outside AT&T's San Francisco headquarters lamented the company's willingness to violate the privacy of its customers by voluntarily handing over their call records to the National Security Agency and allowing the NSA to tap its internet backbone. Interestingly enough, AT&T employees were caught on video photographing the crowd. Meanwhile, big phone and cable companies continue their deception campaigns as they feverishly try to quash the Rainbow Coalition of Network Neutrality and Community baby television supporters. The smallest of the baby bells, Quest Communications, recently mass-mailed its employees, urging them to contact their congresspeople to vote against any legislation that preserves internet freedom or local cable TV franchising. Quest even set up a website where employees could send automated comments to their representatives. And yet another telecom AstroTurf group, called TV for Us, is now conducting highly unethical telephone push polls. If you get one of these calls, you'll be asked whether you support large internet companies jacking up your online access charges. However, if you challenge them on their spin, they promptly end the call. The supporters of TV for Us include AT&T as well as several telecommunications equipment manufacturers. Many thanks to the citizen journalists at Chicago Media Action, Acme Boston, and the Manhattan Neighborhood Network for providing audio for this report. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you live today, May 28th, 2006, from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And before we go to today's guest, let me give you an update on last week's pledge drive. As you know, last week was one of our marathon two-hour shows, and we had Phil Donahue call in and Jeff Cohen and Amy Goodman. All three of them took precious time out of their weekends, what they enjoy of weekends, to call in to help us try to raise money for WILL and to support Media Matters. And I'm delighted to say we had a terrific week. The 2 hours that we did Media Matters last week, I think we had 70 people call in with pledges, and the pledges totaled over $7,000, which is roughly half the amount I think the station wanted to make all day long on both AM and FM. So we had a terrific day, and that doesn't include a lot of the people who responded earlier to the mailing to renew memberships or the people who pledged online. So again, listenership, Media Matters audience, you really did a terrific job helping support this show and helping to support WILL AM and FM here in East Central Illinois. So thank you very, very much. And we'll do everything we can over the next 6 months here at Media Matters to justify your support for the show. And we're going to start right now today with a guest we've been wanting to have on Media Matters for a long time, Stephen Hill. Stephen Hill is the director of the Political Reform Program of the New America Foundation. He's the co-founder of the Center for Voting and Democracy. He has written many books and articles on the problems with the American electoral process, including a recent book, Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Take-All Politics, which was called by Michael Lynn the most important book in American democracy that's come out in many years. He's written for numerous publications. He's appeared on all sorts of national television. And he has a brand new book out, just come out, 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, an Owner's Manual for Concerned Citizens. I think this book is truly a summation of his work over the past two decades on electoral reform. And we're going to talk to him about it today, and we'll talk about its connection to media. So, Stephen Hill, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you, Bob. It's really a pleasure to be here on your show in particular.
Well, you know, let's start at the top here. And in the beginning of the book, you talk about the problem of American democracy, why you wrote the book. And I think most of our listeners are familiar with the problems of American democracy. And we often talk about the role the media play in either accentuating them or at times alleviating them. But let's talk about what you see as the crisis in American democracy. And then we're going to spend the rest of the show talking about what we can do about it. What is the crisis in our electoral system?
Well, the crisis is, you know, the part of the purpose of the book is that there's no one crisis. There's quite a few of them at this point, you know, whether you're looking at the voting equipment or how we elect the president. I mean, we've seen the defects in how we elect the president in both the 2000 and 2004 presidential elections, and we'll see the defects on display again in the 2008 presidential election.
But, you know, Steve, even before we get into the – I'm sorry, I misphrased the question. Even before we get into the specifics of the concerns of the electoral system, I'm just about the general political culture. I mean, what's the problem that you're trying to fix here more broadly in terms of just the caliber of our democracy?
Well, it really boils down to what kind of democracy do we want to have? Does democracy require participation, a popular type of participation, or could it be what some conservative writers like George Will and Charles Krauthammer call basically a checkoff democracy where, you know, voters, the people aren't really too involved. They just get involved when they're really outraged over something, either a politician's behavior or some outrageous scandal that has occurred. And then suddenly the people rise up and throw some of the bums out, and then they go back to sleep again. So there's really a fundamental question here of, in the 21st century, in the age of globalization, which we are now in, with looming environmental sustainability crises, ecological crises, and on and on and on, what type of democracy is required and what kind of institutions will create that democracy? That's really, in some ways, the crux of what my book is about. And then the 10 steps are sort of about what are the specifics that we need to have in order to create this type of democracy.
Well, what sort of democracy, Stephen Hill, do we have right now, short of any of your reform measures? Just looking at the lay of the land of American democracy, the way decisions are made, the way power is held, how democratic is the United States today?
Well, you know, we're not real good at studying these things, so it's not like we can put it on a scale of 1 to 10 and have it be really a comparative scale between, say, the democracy in Germany or in Japan or what have you. But I think that what we can say about the United States at this point is that there are some parts of our political institutions that work fairly well and other parts that work pretty poorly and are working less and less well. And particularly when you look at, we now have a president who has taken it as a regular policy to basically go along with laws that Congress may pass. This is the only president that has never yet vetoed a law because he knows full well that he's just going to simply ignore the parts of the law that he doesn't want to pay any attention to anyway. I mean, you know, there's been recent reports that this is a conscious policy on the part of the Bush administration. I mean, at that point, if things continue to go in that sort of trajectory, I think we can say that our democracy is going to be, if we were keeping it on a scale of 1 to 10, it's going to be sinking lower and lower towards the 4s and the 3s and the 2s. I mean, but we have to keep these things in perspective. I think that, you know, there are still functioning parts of our democracy that we can work with and build upon in order to make it a lot better.
What, you know, one of the issues that political scientists and journalists talk about when they're gauging the sort of success of an electoral system is voter turnout. For example, when the United States has helped sponsor an election in another country, if there's a high voter turnout, that's often pointed to as a sign that this is a popularly embraced system, that people are conferring legitimacy to it by participating in it. What's the status of U.S. voter turnout today, and how does it rank internationally, and how does it rank historically?
Well, the voter turnout in the United States is quite low, particularly when you compare it to other established democracies around the world. And, you know, it's anywhere from 125th to 138th in the world in terms of voter turnout, somewhere sandwiched between Botswana and Chad, last time I looked. So on the presidential score, in the presidential election last time, we did see a slight uptick. The recent trajectory of going down, down, down each election went up a bit in the 2004 presidential election, but there's no indication that that's really going to have any kind of coattails, and really we're not expecting some huge voter turnout in this congressional elections in November.
Yeah, what percentage of the American adult population age 18 or over will cast votes in the November elections this year?
You know, if we hit 40% of eligible voters, we will be lucky. So 2 in 5 voters, and it's very possible we'll hit, you know, a third or higher. So what that means is, you know, you basically, if, I mean, when you're only hitting a third, two-thirds of eligible voters are not participating, and that means that a majority that gets elected in the House of Representatives, for instance, is a majority of a small sample of voters. So, I mean, that's just one snapshot that really could show you how it's possible that Congress could really get out of touch with the American people.
Is it just random selection which one-third of the voters are going to vote this fall? Or from studies, can we get some sense of who's more likely to vote and who's less likely to vote?
Well, interestingly, Bob, there are some, again, people like George Will and Charles Krautheimer and others who put out this rather interesting thesis that people don't vote because they're satisfied. And so maybe it's just fine in a wealthy democracy like ours. People have better things to do with their time than being involved in the grind of politics. But in fact, that point of view contradicts what we know about who does and who does not vote. And in fact, the non-voters are disproportionately young people, minorities, poor people, people who you think would have least reasons to be satisfied with how our democracy and how our society is working. And so there's just no indication that people are not voting because they're satisfied. It's because they don't feel their vote counts for much. They look out there in the political landscape, and they look at the candidates and what they're saying, and none of these candidates are really talking to any of their real issues. That's what it's about.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Stephen Hill, the author of the brand new book, 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, an owner's manual for concerned citizens. And what Stephen does in this book is that he goes through the critique you've just heard and then has 10 chapters outlining 10 distinct areas where reform can be made in our electoral system, really cutting across a broad range of issues we're going to talk about in the show. The book has just been published by your publisher, is Polypoint Press. Is that right, Steve?
Yes, Polypoint Press, and there's a website for the book, www.10steps.net. That's 1010, not T-E-N.
Okay, 10steps.net, 10steps.net, to find out more about the book. I've just had the privilege of reading the book, and it is a very good read. I mean, you're going to sail through this if you're interested in this issue. And I couldn't imagine there's a single person listening to Media Matters on any sort of regular basis who's not going to be taken in by this issue. And I want to go through a lot of the chapters, Stephen, but first I want to just raise a general issue that I'm sure you hear all the time. I mean, in the book, you're proposing all sorts of changes in how our electoral laws work, even going so far as saying maybe we should just abolish the U.S. Senate, calling for different types of voting. And when I've had discussions with some people on these issues, the response oftentimes is, well, look, this Constitution, that's the way the founders wanted it. And, you know, they're, if not holy, they're certainly, we shouldn't mess with what they had to say. I mean, we shouldn't be tampering with their genius. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think that the one thing that I observe about the founders and the framers is that they were innovators. You know, they were making up the institutions that we know now as the Electoral College and the Senate, which have already been changed since that time, so it's not like they're set in stone at all. But they were making it up whole cloth. They didn't have a whole lot to go on. And so I think for the 18th century, what they designed was pretty cutting-edge stuff. If we want to call it a democracy technology, it was cutting-edge democracy technology. But here in the 21st century, it's clear that their creation is having real problems. And we have amended it, reformed it in previous decades, and there's no reason to think that the conditions of the 21st century are similar to the 18th century. In the 18th century, there were approximately 100,000 voters in 1790. They were all white men of property. Obviously, our society is quite a bit different now. We now have 100 million voters, and you know, we have women who are voting, minorities who are voting, young people, all different ages, people. You don't have to have property in order to vote. So we're a completely different society then. It was also a very agrarian society back then. What people believed and what they thought about the issues were very much tied to where they live, to their geography. Today you have a society where a Republican businessman lives next door to a Latino single mom Democrat, living next door to a Green Party environmentalist, living next door to a Working Families Party class-based perspective, living next door to a Reform Party computer programmer, independent points of view. We're a very pluralistic society, and with the 18th century method we have for electing our legislatures, for instance, only one of those points of view are going to win representation, and everyone else is basically left on the sidelines without representation. So these are the types of dilemmas that are going to become increasingly more obvious as our government becomes more out of touch with the American people.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Stephen Hill, author of the brand new book, 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, an owner's manual for concerned citizens. Stephen Hill, renowned director of the political reform program of the New America Foundation, has been active in this area, writing about it, speaking on it, being an expert on this area for a good two decades. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Stephen Hill today on Media Matters, the phone number 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Lines are open. And, you know, you just alluded, Stephen, to winner-take-all elections, which is sort of the hallmark of the American system. And I think for a lot of Americans, that's the only way you can even conceive of an election being. So if it's not winner-take-all, it's not an election. I mean, the two are synonymous in the minds of many Americans. Explain what the problem is with that thinking and what we can do about it.
Well, the method that we use now, for the most part, is we elect one representative per district, and we think that, as you said, that that's the only way you do elections. But in fact, most established democracies around the world do not do it that way. They use another method broadly known as proportional representation. But even in the United States, there are over 100 localities and even states that are using other methods. Some of them don't elect one district at a time. They use an at-large system. But of most interest, I think, are states like Pennsylvania, where they elect county commissioners with three-seat districts by a method known as limited voting. You, in Illinois, have a history of electing your state legislature through a method called cumulative voting in three-seat districts. And these methods, I think, are quite interesting because compared to what we have now, where, for instance, we're about to have a congressional election, 435 seats up for grabs, up for election, but in fact, we can tell you who's going to win 400 of those seats right now. The lack of competition in our congressional elections is really appalling. 99% of incumbents are going to win re-election. The last two congressional elections was the least number of incumbents were thrown out of office in history in the last two U.S. House elections. So when you use this method like cumulative voting like you did in Illinois, what you saw with these three-seat districts is that two of the seats in a liberal area would be elected by Democrats. The third seat would be elected by a Republican because with cumulative voting and
yeah, explain cumulative voting if you would, Stephen, because I got a strong feeling that 99% of people listening to the show right now have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, in Illinois, up until 1980, you used this method called cumulative voting where if you had three-seat districts instead of one-seat districts. So in other words, you could take three of your single-seat districts right now and you lump them together into one three-seat district. With cumulative voting, a candidate only needs 25% of the vote in one of those three-seat districts in order to win a seat. And so what that meant was in a liberal area, you'd get two Democrats elected to two of the seats and a Republican in the third seat. In a conservative area, you'd get two Republicans elected and a Democrat to the third seat. With 25% threshold, it's possible today with a much more vibrant third-party culture that we have, you'd occasionally get a third-party candidate or an independent candidate getting elected.
Well, I'm confused. Let's say I'm living in a district that's primarily conservative, and there are three seats in my district, and, there are three conservatives running, and all the conservatives vote for the three conservatives. Then aren't we just going to have three conservatives representing us?
No, because you also have liberals running and Democrats running in that conservative district. But
all the conservatives are the majority, and they're going to send their votes for the conservative candidates, aren't they? I mean, how does this cumulative voting address that?
Because what could happen is that the Democrats, you know, they would know that this is a conservative area and we only can reasonably expect to win one seat. So, you know, the ideal strategy and in this sort of system would be for the Democrats to run one candidate, and they say to the voters, with cumulative voting, instead of just putting one vote on one candidate, you can take all three of your votes, because every voter has the same number of votes as there are seats. You can take all three of your votes and put them on one candidate if you wish.
That's what cumulative voting is. That's what I was missing. I don't think our listeners know that intuitively.
Yes, thank you for clarifying that.
Okay.
Yeah, with cumulative voting, every voter has the same number of votes as there are seats to be elected, but you can use those votes however you wish. If you want to put three votes on one candidate, you can. You could put two votes on one candidate, one on another, or one on each of three candidates. You basically can use your votes however you wish, and that's what allows the threshold to be 25% for the minority point of view within that three-seat district.
So that means basically this significant minority opinions get represented. So one of the problems with winner-take-all elections, as I've understood it, is that theoretically, if 51% of the population believes A and 49% believe B, you could have conceivably a parliament or a senate or a house of representatives that's unanimous for A, even though 49% of the population is B, and that
exactly.
That's extraordinarily unrepresentative.
We call it a majority of a majority is a minority. And so when you have half the voters voting for half the candidates, you can end up with a legislature that is very badly out of tune with what the overall electorate wants. In Chapter 4 of my book, I actually have many quotes from Illinois legislators who participated in this system of cumulative voting, people like Abner Mikva and John Porter and both Democrats and Republicans. And they all said it was a better system in Illinois because you didn't have this balkanization of partisan influence where, now Chicago is a solid Democratic city. And so as a result, when the Republicans are in control of things, like they are in the House of Representatives in the Congress in the United States, there's not a lot of incentive for them to do anything for a city like Chicago because Republicans don't win votes there. But under cumulative voting, there were Chicago Republicans who got elected, and there were DuPage County Democrats who got elected.
Well, if it's such a great thing, how come we got rid of it?
you got rid of it at the end of the 1970s during the Ronald Reagan populism, and it was fueled by Pat Quinn, an Illinois populist who's still around in Illinois politics, from what I understand. And what he did was he tied it to decreasing the size of the legislature and in decreasing the amount of money given to the legislature. So it was an anti-incumbent, anti-government thing. And then tacked to this measure was, well, let's get rid of this cumulative voting thing too, which, I mean, in California, for instance, that would violate the single subject rule for constitutional amendments. You wouldn't even be allowed to do that. But in Illinois in 1980, Pat Quinn was able to sneak this onto the ballot by saying, let's downsize the size of the legislature.
Now, one of the things that's often talked about when reforming winner-take-all elections is something called proportional representation, which is widespread around the world. You talk a little bit about it in the book. What is PR, proportional representation, and how realistic is it for the United States?
Well, proportional representation is this classification of electoral systems that are very different from winner-take-all. Instead of electing one seat at a time, highest vote getter wins, with proportional representation, say you could have 3-seat districts, 5-seat districts, 10-seat districts. Let's talk about a 10-seat district just because it's easiest to understand, I think. With a 10-seat district, every seat is equal to the same number of votes, 10%. And so if a political party wins 40% of the popular vote in a 10-seat district, they're going to win 4 out of 10 of the seats. If they win 50% of the popular vote in a 10-seat district, they'll win 5 out of 10 of the seats. If they win 10% of the popular vote, they're going to win 1 out of 10 of the seats. And so by doing this, you open up the political spectrum to other points of view to actually be able to win representation in the legislature. And that, in turn, gives voters the opportunity to look out on the political landscape and see a range of perspectives out there that actually have a chance of winning and that they can cast a vote for. So voters can't be so taken for granted like they are now in the winner-take-all system, where we can tell you which district is a Democrat district, which district is a Republican district. So that increases voter turnout because voters now have something to vote for. They're not so taken for granted. There's all sorts of effects that occur as a result of changing your electoral system along these lines. Even campaign finance inequities are not as significant when you use these sorts of methods. So,
In proportional representation, as I understand it, is the system used predominantly in the democracies of Europe. I mean, that's what you're going to find over there, where you have multiple parties and a much higher voter turnout.
Yes, that's correct. Most of the established democracies in the world are using these sorts of proportional methods, and in Europe as well. You do see, like, for instance, in the UK, they use our winner-take-all system to elect the House of Commons, but then they use proportional representation to elect their representatives to the European Parliament or to the London City Council and some of the regional councils they've set up over there. So some countries are experimenting with different types of methods at different levels of government. France is another example. They use actually our winner-take-all system to elect their National Assembly, but then they use proportional representation for all the local and regional elections.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Stephen Hill, the author of the brand new book, 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, an Owner's Manual for Concerned Citizens, talking about the reforms that he's recommending the United States consider to make our electoral system far more responsive to the will and interests of the people and make our general governance system, therefore, far more democratic and accountable to the citizens of the nation. We've got phone lines open at 333-9455 and the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455 and a couple of callers patiently waiting who I'm going to get to in a second. But before we get to them, Stephen Hill, I do want to conclude this sort of quick discussion as we've gone through cumulative voting and proportional representation. Both of those require quite a bit of reform work on the ground, changing governance in many key ways of the electoral system. But you have a chapter on one reform that is relatively simple but extraordinarily dramatic but could be instituted almost overnight, which is called instant runoff voting. And this is something that's got a lot of attraction in the United States because it seems so easy to do relative to the other measures you suggest. Talk a little bit about instant runoff voting, if you would.
Sure. Instant runoff voting is something that it's a method where voters, instead of just picking one candidate, the candidate who you may like or maybe your lesser of two evils candidate, with instant runoff voting, you get to rank your candidates. You can rank a first choice, a second choice, and a third choice. And if your first choice doesn't win, your vote goes to your second choice as your runoff choice. And the goal of instant runoff voting is to elect candidates that have support from a majority of voters and get it over in a single election. And by doing this, it means voters are liberated to vote for the candidates you really like. You don't have to worry about voting for the lesser of two evils. You don't have to worry about spoiler candidates. In Florida in 2000, for instance, if we had used instant runoff voting, the 100,000 Ralph Nader voters in Florida would have had the option of ranking a second choice. And no question that tens of thousands of them would have ranked Al Gore as their second choice. Gore would have been the recipient of all those runoff votes, those number two rankings, and he would have won the state of Florida and the presidency. But in some ways, even more importantly, the winner in Florida would have had a majority of the popular vote, which George W. Bush did not have in the 2000 election in Florida, as in other states as well. And, you know, you can look at lots of presidential elections, Bill Clinton in 1992, where he had only 43% of the popular vote. 1996, also, he did not have a majority of the popular vote. George Bush in 2000 did not have a majority of the popular vote. So we've had a problem with presidential elections a lot in recent years, where, you know, we can't be certain when winners are winning with less than a majority that they really are the candidate preferred by the most voters in that election. And so that's really what instant runoff voting is about, is making sure the results reflect what voters' true preferences are.
And for listeners unfamiliar with instant runoff voting, let me just amplify a little bit on what Stephen Hillstrom talking about. If you vote for a second choice, if a candidate gets a majority votes with the first vote choices of all the ballots in, they automatically win. You only go to the second choices if no one gets a majority. So eventually, whoever has a majority of the votes becomes elected. I mean, just so that's
exactly. It's a runoff system. It's a way to make sure that the winner has a majority. But instead of having a second round, which many elections in the United States already do, and France has a second round for its presidential election, and which actually caused problems in their last presidential election. It's very possible the wrong candidate won, and that the socialist candidate Jospin would have won with a system like instant runoff voting. But with instant runoff voting, and we're actually using this system now in San Francisco for local elections, and we've seen some very interesting outcomes as a result of that. And Burlington, Vermont just held its first election for the mayor of Burlington using instant runoff voting. So it works extremely well, and there's much interest in bringing this system to higher levels of government, like federal and state offices as well.
And the advantages of it, as I understand it, are that whoever does eventually get elected actually has a majority of the votes, that a majority of the ballots wanted this person either first, second, or third. And secondly, it doesn't penalize people for voting for third parties or fourth parties, because if you're the person you would normally vote against because you think is the most evil was going to get a majority of the votes anyway, it wouldn't matter if you voted for a third party. And if they aren't going to get a majority, then your second choice can count.
That's correct.
You gave the example of Nader with Al Gore.
Right. By doing that, it gives us a truer snapshot of where the electorate really stands. I mean, you know, Ralph Nader in 2000 got 2.7% of the vote, but early on in the polls, he was polling, you know, 15-18%. But as we got closer to the election, voters started making that strategic calculation. Well, if I vote for Nader, I may end up with my least favorite, George W. Bush. So they moved back to lesser of two evils. If we had instant runoff voting, voters would be able to you'd have all the data after the election to see who did the voters put as their number one ranking.
And it wouldn't penalize people for doing third parties, starting up new parties. There'd be a sort of a golden age of new political parties starting. We'd still have majority rule. You know, I'm reminded, as you talked about that, Stephen Hill, the great line of the comedian George Carlin, who said, in America, we have incredible choice for everything except where it counts. And he meant political parties specifically. We're talking to Stephen Hill today, our guest on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. He's the author of the brand new book, 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, an owner's manual for concerned citizens, just came out. You can learn about it on the web at www.10steps.net. We've only talked about a couple of the chapters. There's extraordinary measures in here about direct election of the president, overhaul of the U.S. Senate, maybe even junking it, reforming the Supreme Court. On and on we're going to get to in the show, but we have four people who have been waiting to talk with Stephen Hill here on the phones, and let's get to the phone lines right now. Line 4, Farina, you're on the air with Stephen Hill. Hello, line 4. Are you there? I think we lost line 4, unfortunately. I don't blame Farina probably for falling asleep. I apologize for having you hold off so long. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Stephen Hill.
Good afternoon. I agree with Mr. Hill on most things that he said, but having lived in Champaign County and lived through the cumulative voting system, I'd like to point out its evils. especially in counties where there is pretty much one-party domination. What would happen is that somebody who was friendly with the opposition party, especially, well, here in Champaign County, I'll give the example. This was a very Republican area. And so what they did is the Republican Party would put up two candidates and some fake Democratic candidate who said he was a Democrat. And it was done this way, so you almost had the same three people elected every time in Illinois. And then what we did locally here is there was a group that called themselves the Reform Democrats, and they put up their own candidate. And we were able to get a fine woman, Helen Satterthwaite, elected as a real Democrat and not just as a cooperative Democrat. And that worked just fine, and we had really one real Democrat and not the other gentleman whose name I don't want to mention, of course.
Well, caller, can I just clarify, is this a problem with cumulative voting, or is this just a problem with the way that it was manipulated by powerful parties, not the cumulative system itself?
Well, the problem is that most places in Illinois are like a 2-to-1 kind of thing, and most people in Illinois applauded Quinn for having gotten rid of the three-prong representation and went to the one district, one person. And we here in Champaign County, as Democrats, have done quite well.
Okay, well, let's let Stephen Hill respond. Thank you very much. Stephen Hill?
Yeah, well, they added a feature into Illinois cumulative voting that I do not recommend and is really not part of cumulative voting, where they actually limited the number of candidates that could be nominated. And so it did create a type of party machinism that, does not have to be part of cumulative voting. I mean, there are other places using cumulative voting that did not suffer from that feature of Illinois politics. So that really was something that was somewhat unique to the party machines trying to manipulate cumulative voting. Having said that, if you look at Illinois politics today, it has one of the least competitive rates, competitive races in state politics anywhere. The single seat district system has led to absolute uniformity in terms of you have places that are Democratic districts and places that are Republican districts, and there's very little competition for any of the districts at all. So perhaps the caller is satisfied with her representative, but that doesn't mean that the representative is coming from a competitive district. In Illinois, under cumulative voting, you did see more competition, as well as you did see, for instance, a Republican getting elected in Chicago. You had people like Abner Mikva, who was elected in a Chicago district that was very much a machine district, but Mikva was able to run as an independent of that machine, and he didn't have to rely on the machine's money, because when you only needed 25% of the vote, you could go on and knock on doors and raise enough money to win in a race like that. So,
you know, Stephen, as I hear you talk, I'm reminded of what you said about the House of Representatives and how the last two elections had the fewest amount of incumbents turned out. And it was Michael Moore, I think, who argued recently that he went back and looked at Stalin's Politburo, and there was more turnover in the Politburo than there is in the U.S. House of Representatives under Stalin. And, you know, I look at the ballot. I go to vote. I'm a good American, and I vote every election. But, you know, almost every race I vote for, you know the outcome before Election Day because of gerrymandering and these other things. So, I mean, I think it's a testament that 40% of Americans will even vote. I mean, rather than being a low figure, given the fact that so few of our elections are really contested, it's quite a striking statement about people's commitment to civic life.
Well, I think so, because there's not a whole lot to vote for. It's kind of an act of faith at this point. You know, I mean, I live in San Francisco, and my representative is Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic House Minority Leader. She ran unopposed this time in the Democratic primary. She'll have only, you know, symbolic competition in November. And, you know, because it's a heavily Democratic district. There's no chance for Republican to win here or any other perspective as well. And it turns out that most districts are like this, including state legislative districts in Illinois right now. They work, you know, the same way. There's no competition. Incumbents are easily reelected. I mean, in Illinois, it even leads to additional problems where you have what they call the four tops, the legislative leaders in both the Senate and the House, that dominate politics, and they take the money and they sprinkle it to the handful of candidates that have competitive races in Illinois, and by doing that, they buy themselves these leadership positions. It's what I call in Chapter 8 the pyramid of money. where you have at the top of the pyramid the legislative leaders, the four tops in Illinois, or you know Tom DeLay before he stepped down, and or Nancy Pelosi for the Democrats in the Congress, and they, because of this geographic system that we have, where you have one district at a time, and we can tell you right now who's going to win most of these districts. They raise tons of money. Nancy Pelosi can raise a ton of money in San Francisco, even though she doesn't need a dime for her own reelection, and then she hands it out to the colleagues that do have the, you know, in the 35 districts that are going to be competitive. And by doing this, she buys herself the leadership position. So the single-seat district system is tied into our campaign financing system, and they work together like a hand in a glove in a way that really makes our politics very skewed and distorted.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Stephen Hill, talking about his new book, 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy. You can learn more about this brand new book and Stephen Hill at his website, or the website for the book, which is www.10steps.net. We have a full bank of phone callers, and I want to get to all of you. We got Farina back on the air. Line 4, Farina, welcome back to Media Matters.
Hi, thanks. Sorry about that. It's a new phone. Anyway, given all that you're saying, and given that I believe Crispin Miller and Greg Plast have both said that not only the 2000 election, but the 2004 elections were already stolen, how can we, what's the first and most important thing we can do to actually get our democracy back? Because we got to believe that the 2008 elections are already set up for stolen.
Thank you very much, caller. Well, this is certainly a theme we hear a lot from callers to Media Matters, and you see all over the place the concern about the strength of the actual validity of the way elections are counted and the voting machines. And you point out in your book, Steve Hill, that there's far more supervision of the slot machines in Las Vegas and oversight of them than there is of our voting machines. And it's the first chapter of your book. So what do you say to this caller?
Well, I would say a few things. One, there certainly were a lot of disturbing irregularities in the 2004 election, and you know, we probably don't have time to go into a lot of them. And probably your callers are familiar with a lot of them. I think Greg Palast has done a great job in a lot of his investigative reporting. But in the terms of the 2004 election, I have to part company with him a little bit, just in the sense that you know, allegations and evidence is not proof of a stolen election. I think we have to be careful, because the flip side of it is we tell people that the elections are going to be stolen, then people are not going to turn out to vote. And so we don't want to encourage that kind of apathy, and we want to be, I think, responsible in how we talk about these issues. What I came to the conclusion over the 2004 election was the following, is that there were a lot of disturbing irregularities. There was no smoking gun about a stolen election, but we also could not say with 100% certainty that the correct election won, the correct candidate won in the 2004 election, just as we know in the 2000 election that the wrong candidate won. So this to me is enough evidence that we have to do a lot to fix the system. And so it becomes a question of, we don't necessarily have to prove that there was fraud in the 2004 election. We know enough right now to move forward to do the things that need to be done to make sure every vote counts. So the question is, what do we need to do? And that's where I think it comes down to the following. We need impartial election officials. We have to make sure that those who are counting the ballots are fair and not partisan. In the 2004 election, we had secretaries of state who were the co-chairs of the George Bush campaign. That's not right. We have to disallow that kind of thing. We have to have professionalization of election administration. A lot of election administrators today, they're well-meaning, but they're clearly beyond their abilities. A lot of people who, you know, have been running elections for many years, they started out when they were hand-counting ballots with paper and pen. But today, elections, you have computers involved, sophisticated databases, public relations. These people need training, and badly. We also need a National Elections Commission that establishes national standards so that we can say that a provisional ballot in Ohio is the same as a provisional ballot in California. That says that you know, the way they use voter IDs are not going to be abused in different places. So we know what needs to be done, and I would suggest that people roll up their sleeves and get involved in that if they're really concerned about the security of elections, because if we don't, then people are going to get apathetic and just think, like, what's the point? My vote's not going to count anyway.
Our guest, Stephen Hill. You're listening to Media Matters and WILL AM 580. In the next few weeks, we're going to have some terrific guests for you. We've got Steve Kinzer from the New York, former foreign correspondent for the New York Times, joining us in a couple of weeks. We have Stephen Hartnett and Laura Stengram from the University of Illinois community talking about their new book coming up soon. And we're working to get George Monbiot and Eric Bollert, two journalists who have been doing some important work, on the air in the next few weeks. So stay tuned to Media Matters. Let's go back to the phone lines right now for our guest, Stephen Hill, and see what we've got cracking there. Line 2, Charleston, you're on the air.
Hello. Excellent topic for a program. I have two question-comment combinations. First, as a mathematician, I'm aware that there's a lot of research that's been done on the mathematics of elections with more than one candidate. And the current thinking, which is pretty well established, you know, rigorously, is that, well, of course, all systems of voting are manipulable to some extent and can be, you know, corrupted, but the best system is believed to be a system that's actually quite old, developed by Charles Borda in, I believe, the early 1700s. And the way it works is that if there's, say, four candidates, what the voter does is rank all the candidates, giving four to their favorite and three to their second choice and so on. And then the numbers are simply added up. And that tends to produce a winner that best reflects the wishes of the electorate. So I was just wondering, first of all, if the guest was aware of that research. And my second question involves the stimulation of participation in democracy beyond voting. Recently in Boston Review, there was a really nice series of articles about deliberative bodies and stimulating deliberative bodies, including one that was particularly good, I thought, about the process of participatory budgeting in Brazil, in cities such as Porto Alegre, and involving citizens in making choices. And it seems to me that, you know, voting is only the tip of the iceberg. I've gone and, you know, door-to-door for candidates. I'm sometimes really appalled to realize that most of the people I talk to don't know anything about the issues beyond the name of the incumbent. And even if our media system were better, absorbing media is still relatively passive, and it's not clear people would make the most informed decisions without an opportunity to really talk to each other and deliberate the issues in a constructive way. So I was wondering if the guest book dealt at all with that topic. So I'll hang up.
Well, thank you very much, Charleston. Stephen Hill, what's your response?
Well, on the first question, the Borda system, yes, I'm very aware of the system, and there's other systems like approval voting and pairwise and others. There's quite a vast field of academic literature on this subject, and it's all fascinating stuff. And my response would be that they're all better than what we do now, in actual fact. And the reason why I tend to focus on instant runoff voting is because of all these different systems that are better than what we do now, it's the one that has the most track record in other nations and even in the United States. Instant runoff voting is used to elect the president of Ireland. It's used in Australia to elect their national House of Representatives. It's used to elect the mayor of London. Ken Livingstone was elected using instant runoff voting. And so, you know, we tend to, as much as possible, draw from best practices where there's a track record and we can have a sense of being able to say, here's what the predicted outcomes will be with this type of method. So,
plus, isn't instant runoff voting the easiest to do without changing anything? I mean, basically, everything can remain intact. You're just changing that voting procedure. But, you know, unlike cumulative and other things, we're monkeying with districts and stuff.
Right, this is true. And, well, the other system that the caller raised, Borda, and they're all single-winner reforms, so they all, none of those would mess with the districts either.
Yeah.
They all could be used to elect, say, a governor or a mayor or what have you. So, Borda is a good system. In terms of participation and beyond voting, it's a good question. And I actually do go into that a little bit in one of my chapters, a little slightly different than participatory budgeting, as they do in Brazil, but it's what is called a citizens' assembly, what they did in British Columbia last year, where they randomly selected 160 people using the voter rolls, one man and one woman per legislative district in British Columbia, who then were brought together and charged with the task of studying the electoral system in British Columbia, which at the time was a winner-take-all system, and deciding whether they should change to a different system. And they deliberated over a period of 11 months, including holding hearings all around the province. I've talked with some of the members of the Citizens Assembly as well as the leaders of it who set it up. You know, a lot of these members of the Citizens Assembly went back to their geographic districts during this 11-month period and became sort of mini celebrities and really encouraging sort of across the fence conversations between neighbors about democracy and how important it is, and really created a civic momentum in British Columbia around this entire process. And that led to a vote in the Citizens Assembly process. They were charged with the power to put on the ballot a change to the electoral system. They chose to put on the ballot a proportional representation system that then was voted on. It got 58% of the vote. Unfortunately, the powers that be had legislated that it must get 60% in order to pass.
Mm-hmm.
So this led to a huge outcry. They pointed out that the electoral system won more votes than the party in power. And so the party in power has done the right thing, and now they're going to put it back on the ballot again.
Yeah, I'm reminded, Stephen Hill, that in ancient Greece and Athenian democracy, there was no such thing as really the elected representative. You had the full assembly in which all citizens were eligible to participate as equals. And then you also had the jury system, similar to the Citizens Assembly of British Columbia, which had a tremendous amount of power over decision-making. And the idea was you just took people at random from the population. You didn't have elections.
Yes, and so these are the sorts of, I think, mechanisms that we have to begin experiment with. I don't think it's going to replace representative government, just because when you think of Athenian democracy, you're talking, again, about a small electorate.
Mm-hmm.
So you could bring everyone together in the town square or what have you and vote. Today we're a country of almost 300 million people, and it's going to be hard to hold a town square election or meeting for everyone where everyone can participate. And what you'd find when you do that is that the people who have more money, who are retired and what have you, tend to be the ones who participate, and those who are working and you know, the working class have a harder time. So I think the challenge here, as we now are in the 21st century, is really looking at these different methods and these different institutions and figuring out what is the best for a pluralistic society. How can we use things like deliberative polling? How can we use things like citizens' assembly to enhance our representative democracy experience? I believe they can be, and we actually have introduced a bill here in California working with a couple of legislators for a citizens' assembly in California. So we'll see.
You know, we have three callers I want to get to before the end of the program at the top of the hour, but real quickly, as I read your book, and I've been active, as you know, in media policy issues, and some of the stuff you talk about in the book here. You know, what always jumps out is how do you get these politicians to go along with this? I mean, they're the incumbents. They're the ones who are in office, beneficiaries of this status quo. They're not the ones who have any great incentive to alter the system. Doesn't that really ratchet up the degree of difficulty, the barriers to winning fights on these issues?
Well, sure. When you're talking about political and social change, it takes time, it takes patience, and it takes a crisis, frankly. In fact, the book opens up with a quote from Milton Friedman, who, I do not quote on much of anything. He's in my politics, very different. But he had a very wise quote here, which was, "Only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change. When that crisis occurs, the actions that are taken depend on the ideas that are lying around. That, I believe, is our basic function, to develop alternatives to existing policies to keep them alive and available until the politically impossible becomes politically inevitable." And that's what I believe we're doing with electoral reform, is that we are planting seeds right now that when the next crisis occurs, and let's face it, we had one in 2000, we almost had one in 2004, you know, who knows what's around the next bend. Things are rather strange in the United States in many ways right now. That when society looks for the solutions, they pick from the solutions that are available. So I would encourage people, if you're working at the local level, in fact, in Minneapolis just recently, the Minneapolis City Council just voted to put instant runoff voting on the ballot this November. Voters in Minneapolis are going to be voting on instant runoff voting. So for those of you who are in Illinois, who are close by and can maybe help out with that campaign, I would urge you to either send money or go there and walk some precincts, because there will be a campaign. If we do it at the local level, and then we start slowly getting on board the politicians, for instance, Howard Dean and John McCain, who don't often see alike on things. They both are supporters of instant runoff voting. So is Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. and a lot of other politicians, both Republicans and Democrats.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines now. We've only got a few minutes left. I have three people very patiently waiting to talk with Stephen Hill, author of the new book, 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy. Line 3, Effingham, you're on the air.
Yes, I got a couple of things here I'd like to discuss. One, somebody pointed out not too long ago that the election of 1992, where Ross Perot got about 20% of the vote, which was roughly 20 million, that would translate into about 85 members in Congress he would have had. And another thing, is it's, I believe that the third parties are kept off the ballot in a good many cases by the states. So I know they're kept off by the states, but I don't see why the states should keep people off the ballot that are running in it for a national office. I know in Wisconsin in 2004 that on the left the Workers' World Party and the right the Constitution Party were kept off, and I'm sure it was because they were the powers that be were afraid that they were going to take votes.
Okay, caller, let's let Stephen Hill get in here because we're running out of time. You made some excellent points, Stephen. 1992. Some people think that if you had instant runoff voting, George Bush the first would have been reelected because most of those Perot voters would have marked off Bush ahead of Clinton.
It's certainly possible. I've seen conflicting reports on that. The Perot supporters were sort of throw the bums out voters as well, and so they weren't too happy with the incumbent George Bush. The evidence I've seen is it's not clear at all who would have won, but it is conceivable. I mean, with instant runoff voting, you'd have a winner that had a majority of the vote. That's the goal, and we did not have that.
Now, in the second point the caller made, we don't have much time. I mean, if we had laws that made it easier to start third parties, and certainly the laws are onerous in most states about getting a third party on the ballot.
They're rigged by the Democrats and Republicans.
They're absolutely rigged. But unless you have something like instant runoff voting, that whole winner-take-all thing, seems to really push a lot of people towards voting for lesser of two evils, even if you had other choices on the ballot.
Yes, it's true. In California, we have 8 ballot-qualified parties, so you have 2 major parties and 6 minor parties. And the minor parties really, they just never win at the state level. There was one legislator, Green Party, who won a few years back, but it was kind of a fluke. And it's just that in the winner-take-all system, it's really difficult for third parties to win a plurality or a majority of the vote. So, the ballot access laws are rigged. There's no question that that's another thing that has to be changed in order to open up the political system. And I think other efforts like fusion also has potential, and I go into that a little bit in the book. The point of the book was to say, because I hear people saying there's so many things that need to be done, and they get overwhelmed with it, and to have something where we could say, okay, here's kind of a plan. Here's the 10 most important, and if we focus on these, and at the end of each chapter of the book, there's actually contact organizations that if you want to work on campaign finance reform or media reform, and here's the groups that are working on that, and here's their contact information. So the book is attempting to sort of give people to narrow down what we have to do and sort of give us a little bit of a plan and then help us to plug into efforts that are going on.
Yeah, it absolutely does that in the book. And I urge people, again, if you're interested in this subject, go to the website, learn about it. It's 10steps.net, 10steps.net, the title of the book, 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy by Stephen Hill. We have time for one more caller. Line one, Eureka, can you please make it short
and sweet?
I'll
make it very quick. I just want some statistical confirmation. The 99%, was that for both the House and the Senate or just the Senate, the incumbents that win?
Okay, thank you. The figure for incumbents that win, the 99% figure, House, Senate, both, what is that, Steve?
I was thinking of the House, but it's actually true of the Senate as well. There's very little turnover in the Senate.
Okay, well, actually, we got through all our callers, amazingly enough. So that's a good sign. Now the band tuning up. I mean, Travis Smiley's pounding on the door trying to get in here, but we're going to hold him off for a few more seconds. What else would you say, what should people do besides read your book? What steps should they take if they're interested in really changing the electoral system in this country?
Well, first thing is to don't get discouraged. Some people say it'll never happen. I've talked to Germans who, in the early 1980s, did you think the Berlin Wall was going to fall in 7 years? And they said no, and we didn't think in 1988 the Berlin Wall was going to fall. So you never know where you are on the wheel of history. We're engaged at planting seeds right now, and whether you want to work on public financing of elections for your local races, do that. Instant runoff voting for your local races, do that. Media reform. We there's no question that there's change coming in this country.
All right, Stephen Hill, on that wonderful note, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Producer has been Andrea Boyle, Technical Director Brett Polson. I'll be back in 167 hours. And again, thank you all listeners for your terrific support during the pledge drive last week. Bye-bye, Stephen Hill.